In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. In the 19th century, people began to find the bones of impossible monsters hidden deep within the earth. But what strange and spectacular creatures could these bones belong to? And what did they mean both for religious beliefs and new evolutionary theories? On today's episode, Michael Taylor, the author of a new book on the subject, joins Rebecca Franks to discuss how the discovery of dinosaurs shook up Victorian Britain.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. We're here today to talk about your new book, Impossible Monsters and the Discovery of the Dinosaurs in the Early 19th Century. I wondered if we could start our story with Mary Anning, who in 1811 found a fossilised skeleton on the Dorset coast. Who was she and how did she come to be fossil hunting?
Well, first, thank you very much for inviting me onto the podcast. And Mary Anning is indeed an excellent place to start. So in 1811, whenever it's actually her brother, Joseph, who makes the first discovery, the first major discovery, Anning is an 12-year-old teenager. She comes from a very poor family. Her father, Richard, was a cabinet maker and he had died a few years previously. And so in pursuit of a little bit of money to keep the family in bread and keep a roof over their head, both Mary and Joseph had followed in their father's footsteps by hunting for fossils along what we now know as the Jurassic Coast in Dorset and in Lyme Regis. So they went out looking for fossils or shells known as ammonites, and they would sell these curios, as they called them, to a lot of the seasonal holidaymakers who came down to Lyme Regis, which played host to those holidaymakers who were taking the salt water as a means of improving their health. And by 1811, Anning, who had already survived a fairly remarkable and dramatic incident when she was struck by lightning at the age of only a few months, found something that they thought was a crocodile. So Joseph first found this remarkable skull with a long protruding snout and fearsome teeth, but he had to go back to work. So he charged Mary with finding the remainder of the body. And eventually, about a year later, she found the remains of this creature, its skeleton, high up in the rocks of the cliffs around Lyme Regis. And she and a number of men brought this body down, pieced it back together, and it looked absolutely remarkable because this was something unlike anything that anybody had seen before. It wasn't obviously a crocodile. In fact, it looked a little bit more like a fish. So this was put together and it was sold to a museum in London and it was sold for quite a lot of money. So the Annings were comfortable, at least for a while. Initially, one of the major figures in London science called it a proteosaurus because it thought it resembled a salamander known as the Proteus. But in time, this became known as the ichthyosaurus, a fish lizard. It's not a dinosaur. It belonged to a class of prehistoric creatures known as thunosaurs. But it was the first of these impossible monsters, as I call them in the book, or really as Charles Kingsley, the novelist, first called them. And it was the discovery which commenced the systematic study of these giants in the earth.
What were the sort of more outlandish theories about what people thought these bones could be? I mean, perhaps the idea of the impossible monsters, that's the outlandish idea, but what were people thinking they were?
Well, we have to remember that many people had to conform their ideas of science and these discoveries to the intellectual world in which they lived. So they had to take into account the idea that extinction was heresy, because, you know, if we go back to the tale that everybody learns in their childhood about Noah's Ark, Noah saves every single creature from the flood. And even if he didn't bring in creatures which swam in the oceans for obvious reasons, because they would survive the flood anyway. It was thought that if a creature went extinct afterwards, well, there was no biblical evidence for that, so there couldn't necessarily be any scientific evidence for that. So whenever they discover these creatures, and Anning later discovers something that is known as the plesiosaurus, which is described as a snake being threaded through the body of a turtle, it becomes the role model for the myth of the Loch Ness Monster. It appears in Jules Verne's. These things, completely unlike anything, they had to reckon with, well, where are the rest of them? They had to ask themselves, if every creature was preserved from the time before the flood, where were they? People began to call them, you know, fantastic beasts and flying dragons, but there really wasn't a terminology or enough knowledge. There wasn't a critical mass of paleontological knowledge in order to grapple with these things in a systematic and serious way.
And it was a bit later that she came across the plesiosaurus, wasn't it, in 1823?
Yes, it was about 10 years later.
And there were other people as well making discoveries during this period.
Well, not only was Lyme Regis host to a very competitive market for these things, so Mary Anning was very far from the only person looking for these creatures in Lyme Regis, but she was, by all accounts, the most instinctive, the most determined, and perhaps therefore the best of these hunters in Dorset. But there were certainly two main other figures in this period, in the 1810s and 1820s, who were making major discoveries in other parts of Britain. So William Buckland came from an incredibly different background, was a fellow at the University of Oxford. He was by training an Anglican priest, as almost everybody at Oxford was at that time. So Buckland had begun the study of geology at the university. He delivered the inaugural lecture in the subject in 1819. He also went up to Kirkdale outside Scarborough in Yorkshire and made the incredible discovery of the bones of what we would regard as tropical or African animals in a crevice in Yorkshire. And that posed the question, well, how on earth did the bones of all of these creatures get there? Was it evidence? Everybody was very excited about this, that the flood was a real geological event. Could the waters sweeping across the earth explain how these creatures had made their way and there died in that cave in Yorkshire? Buckland, to his eternal credit, and this gained him an awful lot of scientific kudos, said, no, that couldn't possibly be the case because there wasn't any way into the cave. And he posited instead the theory that hyenas, who had been living in Britain at the time, you know, tens of thousands of years ago, had killed these creatures and then dragged their bones inside the cave. Buckland was also interested in more reptilian creatures from the ancient past. And in 1824, he announced the discovery of the first of what we now know as the dinosaurs. And this, he and James Parkinson, who was the doctor who discovered the eponymous palsy, they called it the Megalosaurus. So the identity of this creature had been a puzzle for many of Oxford's great scholars for a very long time. Robert Plott and Richard Brooks in the 17th and 18th centuries had wondered whether this belonged to a Roman elephant. They also wondered whether some of the fossils might have belonged to particular parts of the human anatomy, because they described it initially as the scrotum humanum, which I'm sure you can work out what that means. But Buckland, with the help of Georges Cuvier, who was the great titan of French zoology, he realized that all of these bones put together were of a predator, they were of a reptile, and that was the Megalosaurus. That was the first dinosaur.
Was there huge excitement at the time around these discoveries?
Well, there was certainly a moment in 1824 where everything seemed to coalesce together. So on the very same night that William Conybeare and Henry de la Beach presented their findings on Anning's plesiosaurus, William Buckland would announce the Megalosaurus, and Gideon Mantell, who was the third major explorer of the earth in this period. He was a physician who, while he was touring the countryside attending to his patients, would be looking through the earth, often with his wife, and it's disputed whether it was he or his wife Marianne who made this discovery. But he had found what appeared to be a series of teeth, fossilized teeth. And after some debate, people said, oh, this is nothing, they don't belong to anything. And there was some controversy, because why would herbivores have these kinds of teeth? That was not known before. He announced on the same evening that he had found another dinosaur, at least what becomes known as dinosaurs, and this was the Iguanodon. The name, you know, Don refers to the teeth, and the iguana, because he was looking through lots of specimens at the Royal College of Surgeons, and it was suggested that the closest comparator in the living world was the Caribbean iguana. So we have, in 1823-24, the beginnings of the science of paleontology as we know it. And that's not to say, you know, it takes another 17 years before we begin to describe these creatures as dinosaurs. But there is by this time, a real popular interest in geology and paleontology and what the evidence of what we now know as the prehistoric world could tell us about the actual history of the Earth.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
I wondered if we could set this a bit more in the context. We've hinted there or discussed already that these scientific discoveries were often being measured up against how religion described the creation of the world. Could you perhaps just set up what the religious landscape of the country, I mean, we are talking about Britain in the main part for the moment. What was the religious landscape at that time?
It may actually be helpful to answer that question by talking about what the landscape of science was like, at least in the 1810s and 1820s, because we might think of the Enlightenment of mostly the 18th century as this wonderfully radical, awesome force which swept away religious dogma and established these principles of rationalism and empiricism, which meant that Britain was becoming a more scientific place. But that didn't necessarily happen. The British Enlightenment, or certainly the English Enlightenment, was quite conservative. It always thought to conform new evidence and new ways of scientific thinking with religious assumptions. And science itself was nothing like the profession that we know today. It was conducted in a very few institutions. It was conducted only really by the quite wealthy gentlemen who could afford the spare time to conduct these experiments, to go on their field trips, who often regarded these scientific societies as forums for socialization rather than the advancement of scientific knowledge. And what this state of science in the early 19th century meant was that there hadn't really been a serious challenge to many of the religious assumptions which people had. Britain was a very deeply religious place. By the time of the 1810s and the 1820s, of course, some of the more cerebral people who were commentating on these matters had begun to doubt that the world had been created in 6 days in 4004 BC, as Archbishop James Usher had once pronounced. They had begun to realize that the 6 days of Genesis might have been a metaphor for longer ages of the earth. But they were in a minority, and it was incredibly dangerous in many circumstances to question either the accuracy or the morality of the Bible. Publishing Tom Paine's Age of Reason, which many people would look back on now as one of the foundational great texts of secular rationalism, could land you in prison quite comfortably. And so there was a real danger for people like Anning and Buckland and Mantell that if they were to put forward ideas of science which radically undermined confidence and faith in Christianity, there would be severe social penalties. Of course, Buckland was never going to do that. He was an Anglican priest. He was quite socially conservative himself. The leitmotif that we see in his entire career is reconciling one to the other. Mantell's faith was never shaken. But certainly people maybe of the next generation who begin to look at the evidence and who begin to suggest, or begin to think, I should say, that the evidence cannot sustain a biblical interpretation of the earth, they begin to push at the boundaries of what is socially acceptable.
And during this period, were these discoveries staying then within this kind of intellectual realm? What was the kind of wider public knowledge of what was being found and what was being suggested?
Certainly for the first 10 or 20 years, these are debates which are taking place within a relatively narrow band of educated men, mostly men again, fellows of scientific institutions, review journals, and the readers of the occasional scientific journal that had been published. But by the 1830s, this begins to change, and it begins to change thanks mostly to Charles Lyell, who had trained as a lawyer but hated the job, and his passion really was geology. He loved exploring, and in the late 1820s, he went on a research expedition with the husband and wife, Roderick and Charlotte Murchison, through the south of France and then down to Naples. And everything that Lyell saw suggested to him that the biblical account of the earth couldn't possibly be correct because, you know, he was walking through volcanic ranges in the Auvergne, and in Naples he saw evidence with his own eyes that the levels of the sea and the earth had been changed since the 3rd century when a particular Roman temple had been built. So Lyell put forward all of these ideas in a book called The Principles of Geology. It's probably one of the most important books in the history of science. It puts forward a really, really radical idea that all of the changes that could ever have affected the Earth could only be the same changes that were observable in the present day. So that means that it wasn't just creation and the deluge, but there had been changes in the nature and the levels of the Earth over time, and that geology as a science for the first time would be able to look and to observe all of the changes happening in the present day. Now, that sounds radical, that sounds really dangerous, but the really clever thing that Lyell and his publisher John Murray did was to restrict this idea, at least until it found acceptability within the scientific community, to readers who were of a certain wealth. It was only after he established the scientific credentials for this idea that it was put forward in a book that people other than the very wealthy could afford. It helped that Lyell himself was quite conservative. So again, like Buckland, he finds a way of, almost by a process of osmosis, letting these ideas, which will begin to undermine the idea of what we call creationism, into the public domain.
Who are the other major figures who played a part in this story?
Well, if we're now getting into the 1830s, that means we're encountering Richard Owen, who is the dark prince, I would say, of British science in the 19th century. He's a total swine, but he's brilliant. He's an anatomist who trains in Lancaster, comes down to the Royal College of Surgeons, and quickly knows how to win the scientific game. He knows how to get appointed to the right committees, he makes the right friendships, he gets the funding and begins to control funding for a lot of scientific investigation. And it's Richard Owen in the 1840s who coins the term dinosaurs for the first time. But it's really important to understand that Owen coins the term dinosaurs as a means of challenging the idea of evolution itself. We haven't mentioned that word before, but there had been ideas of what we might call evolution, or at least of developmental theory, the idea that species could adapt and change and become more sophisticated. And these were put forward mostly in France by people like Lamarck and Geoffroy. Owen couldn't deal with that. He found it offensive to his religious sensibilities. This was because the idea that things could improve upon what the Lord had created. Could man possibly have evolved from monkeys? Well, that's offensive because if the Lord had created everything in his own image, the Lord was infallible. He couldn't possibly have made a mistake. And the same thing applied to reptiles and to animals. So by creating the term dinosaur to describe the megalosaurus and the iguanodon and the hylosaurus, which is another sort of armor-plated animal that Gideon Mantell discovers in the early 1830s, Owen was creating this awesome, sophisticated, complex category of animal that he would place at the very beginning of time in order to argue that evolution was bunk. Because if these incredible beasts, which were much bigger and much more complex, much more fearsome than anything alive today, had been alive at the beginning of time, then there couldn't possibly be any sense of, you know, incremental, inexorable progress and change in the constitution of animals. On the other side of this fence, in the 1830s, we have Darwin, of course, who is not necessarily known as a paleontologist, but plays an incredibly important role in this story, because between 1831 and 1836, Darwin is on HMS Beagle. He's sailing around the world. He sets off as a devout Christian, and he writes later that he had no reason or cause at the time of this voyage to doubt that the Bible was literally true. But on Tenerife and in the Andes, he begins to see evidence of the changing nature of the earth. He's reading Charles Lyell's book at the time of this voyage, and he begins to accept that Lyell is probably correct as to geology. And then, as well known, on the Galapagos, he begins to become slightly puzzled by the fact that in all of these islands, which are dotted around the Pacific Ocean, separated by tens, occasionally hundreds of miles, all the species of birds and other creatures are very, very slightly different from one another. So how does this happen? So Darwin comes back to England in 1836. He returns to Shropshire. He comes down to London. He gets married, and then he retires to Kent. He doesn't publish the more dangerous of his ideas for a very long time. He works up his botanical and his zoological findings from the Beagle, and he continues to think about this. A little bit later, the other great figure in this history comes to the fore, and that's Thomas Huxley. And if there is a hero of the book, and, you know, history books often don't have heroes, but I can certainly sympathize and empathize much more with Huxley than with any of the other characters. You know, Huxley is a penniless surgeon who needs to find a way to pay down his medical debts. He's absolutely brilliant. He doesn't really have much formal education. So he decides, in the absence of these polite connections, which can get him into prestigious scientific appointments, that he'll join the Royal Navy as a surgeon. The point of that being, if he's away for 3 or 4 years, he isn't going to spend very much because the Navy will look after everything. And then he'll get paid off the ship whenever he comes back. So Huxley boards the Rattlesnake, he goes to Australia, he finds a fiancée, he studies jellyfish, he creates something of a zoological reputation for himself, and he comes back to Britain in 1851. He's still very poor. 1851 is the year of the Great Exhibition in Hyde Park, and he can't afford to enter the Crystal Palace until the prices are dropped towards the end of the year. But his brilliance eventually wins through. He becomes friends with Darwin, and they begin to correspond with each other. The last of these three great explorers, so if, you know, Darwin circumnavigates the world, Huxley goes to Australia, and Alfred Russel Wallace, who's been in Brazil collecting species of bees and butterflies in the 1850s, decides to embark on another expedition to the Dutch East Indies, to what we would describe today as Indonesia. And it's there, in the jungle, in the rainforest, that Wallace comes up with an idea which is very strikingly similar to the ideas that Darwin had been developing. And these two men are having the ideas completely independently of each other. Wallace is thinking about the ideas of Thomas Malthus, who had imagined that humankind and human populations were constantly in a fight for scarce resources, and that certain checks would always bring population and resources back into some kind of equilibrium. And Wallace, who had seen and catalogued and described thousands of different types of bees and butterflies and other insects in these jungles, began to think, well, why couldn't we apply this principle of population to the natural world more generally? And so he begins to think of this idea of competition among the species. Darwin has had this idea for a long time himself, but it's when Wallace then writes about his idea to Darwin, and Darwin then, prompted by Charles Lyell, so, you know, all of these men talking to each other at the same time, they realize, okay, now is the time for you to put forward this idea of adaptation and the development of species by means of natural selection. Darwin publishes The Origin of Species in 1859. Huxley takes up the cudgel as Darwin's bulldog, propagating this idea of natural selection. Richard Owen is completely aghast by the whole thing, and he begins to argue that this is nonsense, it couldn't possibly be applied to humankind. And Huxley and Owen have this great guerrilla war over whether or not mankind could be inseparably related to chimpanzees and to apes and to gorillas. And you might begin to think, we're a hell of a long way from dinosaurs here. You know, what has happened in the interim? We're talking about bees and butterflies and science and natural selection. But dinosaurs become incredibly important to this story because Darwin himself realizes and confesses in the first edition to The Origin that there isn't very much fossil evidence for his theory. That's his great weakness. But what happens in the 1860s is that paleontologists around the world begin to discover more and more dinosaurs and other types of prehistoric creatures, which begin to suggest that there actually has been a history of evolution and the development of species over time. So many of these discoveries happen in Bavaria, in Germany. The first of them is a feather. And I think many of your listeners will know about the Archaeopteryx, the feathered reptile that appears in so many illustrated books about dinosaurs. The Archaeopteryx is followed quite closely by the Compsognathus. It's a small chicken-like dinosaur. And then in America, a paleontologist called Edward Drinker Cope begins to put all of these things together. He realizes, or rather a fellow paleontologist in America has realized, that how people had thought dinosaurs stood and moved over time was wrong. The discovery of the Hadrosaurus in New Jersey in 1859 begins to present a new picture. So looking at the skeleton of the Hadrosaurus, scientists begin to realize that dinosaurs stood upright, that their legs didn't jut out to the side like many of present-day living reptiles, and so that they stood something like birds. And so, again, we have a scientific community which is beginning to correspond with each other across oceans, by thanks to the telegraph and steamships. We were taking scientific journals here, there, and everywhere with much greater speed and regularity. And by the 1860s, Thomas Huxley is putting all of this evidence together. And what happens is that all of the dominoes suddenly fall into place, the pieces of the puzzle, And he can point to the Compsognathus, to the Archaeopteryx, to other dinosaurs, and to the living bird, and to realize that all of these creatures are created. They're built in the same way. And for Huxley, it's dinosaurs and their relationship to birds and to present-day reptiles, which proves, perhaps in a way that's less volatile and less politically sensitive than by doing so with reference to humankind and to apes, that evolution is real, that there is a scientific record which can provide the transitional fossils that demonstrate the reality and the veracity of the theories that Wallace and Darwin had put forward in the 1850s. And this only accelerates in the 1870s. So by this stage, there's a theory that the primacy in discovering dinosaurs tends to follow the great power, the great industrial power in the world. So for the first 50 or 60 years of the 19th century, it had been Britain. And then Germany becomes to take a greater role. Then we go to the American West. Incidentally, we also think that today, you know, China is the great manufacturing power of the world today, and China is not coincidentally the great fossil bed of the world at present. But in America in the 1870s, we have the Bone Wars in the American West. So we have Edward Drinker Cope, who I mentioned earlier, who's a quite independently wealthy Quaker paleontologist who refuses absolutely to believe that natural selection could be correct and maintains that belief throughout his life. And we have Othniel Charles Marsh, who is the leader of the Paleontological Museum of Natural History at Yale University. And they take their teams and they go out to the American West, where suddenly all of these bones are emerging from the bluffs and the rocks. And they make a series of incredibly staggering discoveries. Again, they find prehistoric birds which have teeth, which reinforces the idea that reptiles and birds are related and that dinosaurs and birds are related. And then they begin to make, you know, the really major discoveries of dinosaurs that we might recall today. So the Stegosaurus comes to light, the Diplodocus comes to light. Eventually, one of Cope's students discovers the Tyrannosaurus rex. And by this stage, at least within these scientific circles, there is beginning to coalesce a consensus that dinosaurs are the missing link, or at least we go from dinosaurs to birds to reptiles. And birds, of course, are dinosaurs. They're the last surviving dinosaurs who managed to survive the cataclysm of 65 million years ago. Where this leaves the majority of people, of course, is a slightly different question, because it's all well and good for a scientific community to have established these principles and to convince itself of the rectitude of their ideas. But did the British public, did the American public really believe the same things? Now, it's probably fair to say that both societies remained really quite committedly religious during this time. But that's not the same thing as saying that secularism or rationalism or even atheism hadn't become much more acceptable over this period, and partly due to the success of science in proving that there may be doubts about certain aspects of biblical history and religious assumptions. But I think by the early 1880s, there are a series of events in 1881 and 1882 which suggest that these discoveries and, you know, the war between science and religion has come to a close, or at least to an armistice. Because in 1881, we have the opening of two museums in London. One is the Natural History Museum. Now, that had been Richard Owen's pet project for a number of years. And so the Natural History Museum, we might now think of a monument to science, but it was really erected by Owen as a monument to science and religion living in harmony together. A couple of hundred yards away in South Kensington, however, Thomas Huxley has erected his own tower, which is the Royal College of Science. And that's where he wants to create the next generation of secular scientists. And I mean secular in the sense that this is people pursuing science untrammeled by religious dogma. At the same time in 1881, Darwin is ill. In 1882, he dies. And Darwin is someone who for a very long time had worried about the religious implications of his ideas and had worried about the social censure that might follow from their publication. But the time that his daughter dies in the 1850s, he's pretty much given up on religion. He doesn't go to church anymore. He begins to read quite deeply of radical theologians. But in 1882, the man who feared that he was the devil's chaplain is interred in Westminster Abbey, which is a moment of incredibly powerful symbolism. In fact, he is interred only a few yards away from Archbishop James Usher, who, of course, had pronounced in the 17th century that the world had been created in 4004 BC at tea time on a Saturday in October. The third moment, I think, really confirms that Britain had changed considerably since Mary Anning made that first discovery in 1811, is the admission to Parliament of Charles Bradlaugh. It's a name we haven't mentioned before. He's not a scientist in any way, but he is a radical atheist campaigner. Now, Bradlaugh, as an atheist, as Britain's most prominent atheist, will not swear the oath whenever he is, in theory, admitted to the House of Commons, that he will do so with the help of God, and he will not swear on a Bible. He refuses to do this. He's imprisoned in Parliament. He's one of the very few people to have been imprisoned in Parliament. And there were repeated by-elections throughout the early 1880s where Bradlaugh stands again, he's elected again, he's rejected. He stands again, he's elected again, he's rejected. And eventually, he wins by a process of attrition, and he is admitted, he's allowed to swear a secular oath, and he becomes the first openly atheist member of Parliament. And that, I think, is rather symbolic of the way in which this intellectual change has worked over the previous 70 years. There isn't a big bang. There isn't a moment where people can stand up and say, ah, well, science now has trumped religion or beaten religion. That's not how it works. It's by this gradual incremental process over the 70 years, by one discovery, by the publication of one idea, by the gradual acceptance of these ideas, much in the same way that evolution happens by natural selection, gradual changes over a very long period of time. We get to the stage in the 1880s where science and religion can coexist. It's not the defeat of one by the other. It's the concession by religion that scientific assumptions and scientific evidence have their place and an unchallenged place in public debates about the world, about morality, about politics, about everything.
As the existence of the dinosaurs began to be widely accepted, how did artists and writers begin to represent them? Do you have any favourite examples that you found during the course of your research?
One of the great joys of writing this book was really finding epigraphs for each of the chapters. Some of them are from the scientific literature, some of them are from political literature, but a lot of them are from novels, just trying to, you know, paint a picture of what people were writing and reading at the time that all of these events were taking place. There's a surprising amount of natural history in Thomas Hardy's books. Maybe the most significant writer in this sense is George Eliot, who had been translating a lot of the, you know, the critical German theology, which had influenced the liberal Anglican clerics we've just talked about, from German into English. And repeatedly throughout Eliot's writings, there are references to natural history and to science and to the progress that science can make within society and within an economy. It also appears quite a lot in Dickens. So there's the famous passage in Bleak House about a megalosaurus waddling up Holborn. It was only waddling, of course, because we had not realised by the time that Dickens had written Bleak House that megalosaurus and other dinosaurs didn't waddle, they walked upright, or at least the megalosaurus did. One of the things that I cite, and we go into at length at the end of the book, to demonstrate how dinosaurs had become part of popular culture by the end of the 19th century and by the, you know, the Edwardian decade, is The Lost World by Conan Doyle. So it's, you know, perhaps the apogee of Victorian adventurism. It's been the source for so many different adaptations and other rip-off novels and sci-fi. An intrepid group of explorers depart for South America, thinking that there might be hidden somewhere within the mountains and the rainforest a hidden kingdom of dinosaurs. Shockingly, they're correct. And they come back with evidence brandishing a pterodactyl. But it's true that as all of these discoveries take place throughout the 19th century, as these scientific assumptions become more acceptable, although still attendant with danger, popular culture begins to reflect this. And people are really, really obsessed with dinosaurs. Whenever the Crystal Palace is taken down and resituated in southeast London, one of the really great attractions at the new site is the creation of dinosaurs. Now, you can still go and see them today, and they look terrible. Not only because they're 170 years old, but also because they're completely wrong. Again, we didn't necessarily know by that stage how dinosaurs looked, how they walked, how they moved. But these were some of the great public features of life in the landscape in Victorian Britain. And it was a source of great national pride that so many of these discoveries and the development of this science, they had been British, or at least they had been brought to public attention by British scientists.
You mentioned there that the idea of dinosaurs waddling and that the models might have been completely wrong. How many kind of weird and wonderful different iterations were there of how people thought the dinosaurs looked and moved? Like, are there sort of great illustrations? You know, what do we get over the years?
There are some really terrible illustrations, it would be fair to say. I mean, one of my favourites, and This isn't terrible. The painter John Martin, who was incredibly popular in the early 19th century, was noted for these vast dramatic landscapes of biblical scenes and scenes of apocalypse and cataclysm, was also instructed by Gideon Mantell to paint or to do an engraving of the country of the Iguanodon for one of Mantell's textbooks in the 1830s. That's in the plates of the book. Dinosaurs are imagined at this stage as dragons, effectively. You know, they look like something that could be borrowed from Greek mythology. And it's important to say that the Britons of the 19th century were not the first people to discover or to talk about dinosaurs. The Greeks were doing it 2,000 years ago. They just didn't call them dinosaurs. They called them griffins and serpents and chimeras and dragons, as the Chinese dragon was almost certainly, because of the proliferation of dinosaur fossils in China based on a dinosaur. So we have, you know, these dragons, we have these waddling creatures of the mid-19th century. Even throughout the 19th century, we still have people wedded to this idea of dinosaurs with four legs jutting out and their bellies scraping along the ground as they walked. But by the 1880s, by the 1890s, people really have understood completely how dinosaurs looked, how they stood, how they moved. And there's an American artist, Charles Knight, who does all of these incredible murals for American museums. And he, for the first time, is putting together these incredibly vivid paintings, maybe not completely accurate, but at least for the first time, people are seeing in colour what a dinosaur might have looked like, how it might have moved. And that period in the 1880s and the 1890s, whenever having dinosaurs on display in museums becomes a real point of prestige, a real point of attraction, and the great mania surrounding the Carnegie Diplodocus in the 1900s, it's a real popular craze. So all of the monarchs of the old world, from St. Petersburg to Vienna, everybody is coming together begging Carnegie for a cast of his Diplodocus, because, you know, this vast great creature, it's still there. There's one in the Natural History Museum today. It was the first one that Carnegie made. They had become great symbols of the role that science was now playing in popular life.
I'd like to ask a question now, which is not strictly within the scope of your book, but you do begin by talking about Jurassic Park, the film that had an impact on you and on me as a child, and many of us, I think. It's a hugely popular film. What impact do you think that film has had on our understanding of the dinosaurs now? Do you relate it in any way to the research that you have been doing?
I don't think I'm sufficiently expert in paleontology today to say whether or not Jurassic Park has created too many myths about how dinosaurs behaved, but I think it's absolutely essential to the popular craze, which still persists concerning dinosaurs. It's not to say that dinosaurs had become unpopular in the 1960s or 70s or 80s, but, you know, this is one of the great blockbusters. As I recall in the book, you know, the first scene where Sam Neill sees the brachiosaurs walking across the grassy fields is remarkable. And I still genuinely have the occasional nightmare in which a velociraptor or a T-Rex intrudes. I think for people of my generation, and I was, you know, 5 when Jurassic Park came out, and I was 8 when it first appeared in TV, they certainly created this new obsession, or this newfound visual obsession. You know, if we talk about how the drawings and then the Crystal Palace dinosaurs had become attractions in Victorian life, and then how the murals and the paintings, the illustrations of the books and the novels of the late 19th century, and then the Carnegie dinosaurs had created a really compelling visual culture surrounding dinosaurs, then, you know, since 1993, Jurassic Park and the sequels have created a popular cultural phenomenon which still beguiles me and for which I am eternally grateful.
That was Michael Taylor. His book, Impossible Monsters, Dinosaurs, Darwin, and the War Between Science and Religion, is out now, published by Bodley Head. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer-Arden.